I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. There's a terrific documentary playing in Vancouver at least four times over the next couple of weeks. It's at the Van City Theatre here in Vancouver, December 20th, 22nd, 24th, and January 2nd. It's called When Jews Were Funny, and it's a thoughtful, perceptive look at Jewish comedy, or the brand of comedy that one saw a lot of in American show business that was heavily influenced by Jewish comics. The film is also a 60-something's introspective look at the sort of comedy that he saw growing up on television, but importantly around him, from his grandparents, their friends, and the sort. Alan Zweig, who made this very fine film, joins me now. We'll talk about this movie, the themes explored, such as Are Jews No Longer Funny? Or How and Why Has Jewish Humor Changed? I'll ask him about some of the people he talks to in the movie, comedians such as Shelley Berman, Shecky Green, Norm Crosby, Howie Mandel, Gilbert Gottfried, David Steinberg, Mark Maron, Andy Kindler, Judy Gold, Jack Carter, and so many more. Alan Zweig has been in the film business for well over 30 years. His notable documentaries include Vinyl, A Hard Name, Lovable, and the terrific I, Curmudgeon. When Jews Were Funny was a big hit at the recent Toronto International Film Festival, where it won the award as the best Canadian feature. Visit whenjewsworefunny.com for information, and for tickets, visit viff.org. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto today, Alan Zweig. Mr. Zweig, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, I read somewhere in another interview you gave that this was really the first film of yours that you sort of looked at your Jewish background, that you hadn't done that before. Was there something that you were looking for in the course of making this movie, something from your past?
Well, you know, the film was inspired by my feeling that maybe, you know, it sounds silly, I couldn't escape my past. So I guess I was just looking, you know, in all these films, I'm just looking to see on some level whether other people have any advice for me or any, you know, whether talking to people about these issues will make them clearer for me. And I think it happened. It's hard to be so straightforward and say that you changed. But I think that I realized making the film that I missed something in the culture in which I grew up. And that's what the film was about, figuring out.
Well, when did you figure out that Jewish humor or humor in general had changed?
Well, I am not trying to prove any thesis that Jewish humor had changed. It's more about Jews than about humor. It's more about the culture in general than about humor. I think Jewish humor is, you know, if one describes the source of Jewish humor, what makes Jews laugh, what makes Jews, you know, I'm not a theoretician, but if you were to describe what Jewish humor is, Jewish humor itself has not changed. I would contend that we're not as good at it as we were, but what we're trying to do is still the same, I think. I think that, yeah, that's, I mean, the film is hard to talk about,
yeah,
because for me, it's not about Jewish humor as much as it's about being Jewish, and I tried to use humor as the window through which to look at basically Jewish culture or Jewish identity. So I'm just saying, you know, it feels to me like Jewish identity and Jewish culture has changed, and therefore the humor just doesn't strike, and, you know, just doesn't hit me the way it used to.
I guess Jewish comics in the sort of middle part of the 20th century were the I guess the most conspicuous of representatives of say Jews. I mean, that's what people saw on TV.
I just saw a documentary about, you know, comic book artists, and it turned out even, you know, Spider-Man and Superman and all those things, actually, that world was dominated by Jews, and Jews also, and I mean, when I say dominated, it's like, even if 10% were Jews, that would be hugely disproportionate, but in these fields, like comedy, I think it was like 80% where you're less than 0.1% of the population. So, yes, I think Jewish comedians were, there was a period in the late 60s when suddenly some people say that it was like cool to be Jewish. Mm-hmm. There were records that came out that were overtly Jewish, that comedy records sort of, that were big sellers, and yes, it was almost like, you know, somebody in my film said to me that they put Jews on the map.
Yeah. Well, what's the I guess the key to Jewish humor? I mean, it does, as one of the people in the film say, it has a rhythm, doesn't it? I mean, in
right.
The cadence, the inflection, the tone, the delivery.
It's a rhythm. The way I explain it to people who, you know, wonder how is it that Jews, who are such a small part of the population, came to essentially create what we now see as American humor or North American humor. It's simply that, you know, the vast American non-Jewish culture, which is basically American culture, was not one, and you can even see it now, like the whole idea, the whole stiff upper lip, don't complain, don't, you know, you still see how the very idea of neurosis is seen as, you know, unseemly. There's still people make fun of anybody who complains or is neurotic, etc., because the American culture is about, you know, just take it. Just take it and move on. And I think that, you know, vaudeville mm-hmm. came along at the same time as the Depression. Americans, for the first time, they wanted to complain. They had a lot to complain about. They had a lot to be neurotic about. Jews came along who'd been complaining for 5,000 years, and it was a tremendous, you know, outlet for the people to finally let, you know, somebody was complaining for them. And so, yeah, Jewish humor is about complaining. It's about how things are bad. It's about how things don't work out. And it's about making fun of yourself, how bad your life is, rather than pointing the finger at others, although that happens too.
Mm-hmm.
And that now is sort of, you can't even separate that from American stand-up culture. That is what everybody virtually does. But it was, once upon a time, it was exclusively Jewish humor.
Who did you like growing up?
I liked who my, well, when I was, pre-teens, I liked Buddy Hackett and Alan King.
Uh-huh.
And Jackie Mason. This is before I never heard of Lenny Bruce when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
When I was just a teenager, Robert Klein and David Steinberg came on the scene, and Robert Klein was probably my favorite when I was 15 or 16. And I'm trying to think who else. I mean, I wish I could name one who wasn't Jewish.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, I remember who I didn't like, Bob Hope, and he wasn't Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I didn't really like Milton Berle. He was Jewish. But, Buddy Hackett and Alan King, I liked. And I'm not even sure I liked for what they said, just for how plain they were, how direct, how sort of aggressive. And you know, they didn't swear on TV, but you just felt like they were... they would swear if you saw them in person.
Some of the people in the film, including yourself, say that people in their families were often funnier than, say, comedians that they'd see on television. Growing up, did you know that then, or is that just sort of in retrospect?
Well, I mean, that's something, you know, that's a kind of a truism you hear. You know, it's like you hear like Bill Russell, who was a basketball player who I loved, would say that, you know, he wasn't necessarily the, you know, people, you know, in the people became comedians or athletes on some level because they had no choice of doing something else. You know, so it's a long time story you hear that actors or comedians or whatever, they had a brother who was hilarious, but he became a doctor. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if, you know, in some cases maybe they're just being generous. But, you know, David Steinberg says everybody in his family was hilarious. And he was the one who chose to do comedy. That doesn't mean he was necessarily the funniest. He maybe wasn't.
Yeah, the other thing that you say in the film that I found rather interesting was that people that were 60 when you were a kid are a lot different than the people that are 60 now. But I guess you see that in throughout our culture, that, you know.
Well, I think that's, yes, I think that's the part of the film that, I mean, there's a lot of ways that you could say that's true for everybody now, of course, because, you know, people say 60 is the new 50, but, you know, I'm 61. I don't feel 50, but, you know, my grandmother at 60 was an old woman, and I don't feel like I am that old the way she was, but that's partly just because, you know, the average age of death has gone up. But what I'm talking about more is just immigrant culture.
Yeah.
My grandmother was an immigrant, and no matter how long she was here, she never lost that. My mother was the daughter of an immigrant, and that was very much imprinted on her. On me, not as much. Like, it's, you know, I'm connected. I knew my grandmother. I knew the immigrant. There's a, you know, if you're the generation that didn't even know the immigrant, then, you know, I'm not sure how much of that immigrant culture is, you know, when Jews came here, when they came to New York, didn't matter if you were an Orthodox or a complete non-believer, all the Jews basically lived in the ghetto. So the culture was sort of all this big soup of Jewish culture. No matter what you were, that's what influenced you. Now, you know, I live in a, you know, a neighborhood that is thoroughly not Jewish. It's just a downtown, mixed Toronto neighborhood. Most people aren't Jewish. Most people in the world aren't Jewish, period. There's no ghetto for me to be in. My daughter is going to pick up some things from me. It will inform her, you know, maybe. I don't know what she'll, how Jewish she'll feel, but not like me. Like, I was, my first 20 years of life, that was, every influence was Jewish.
See, in watching the movie, I got the sense that that's what you were looking for your daughter. She's two. That you're looking for a connection to your past.
Right. I mean, I didn't know that when I started the film. You know? I didn't think that that was important to me, because I knew that, and it's still true, that it's, you know, I cannot give her what I got, nor should I give it to her. But there's no way I could, even if I wanted to. I cannot, you know, it's sort of like I rejected much of what I was brought up with, but I was still brought up with it, and so it's still in me, and, you know, I can't give her the thorough drenching in Jewish culture that I was given, and not only because, you know, and it's not just because her mother, my daughter's mother, isn't Jewish, but that's one of the reasons. So basically, when I thought about it when she was born, I just thought, well, I won't even try, like, because what I could give her would be so surface. So, you know, it's like being Jewish isn't about eating matzo ball soup, but I could give her matzo ball soup. You know, it's not about eating bagels. So what's the point? Why would I even give her a bagel? It just seems like, it would seem like such a lame way to connect her with the culture. Whereas now I think, you know what, when my daughter says, when I find out that my daughter was talking to her friends about matzo ball soup and none of them knew what matzo ball soup was, and she thought, you know, then I think, oh, that's cool. My daughter's the only one of her friends who knows about matzo ball soup, and, you know, that makes me feel good in some weird way, and maybe that's, you know, the beginning of something. And it's not important. It just, I don't know, I guess, yeah, it's like, it's almost like basically I just want her to know what, something that she would have known if my parents were alive, something that she would know. So the, you know,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's so unimportant in some ways, like, you know, culture, who cares? And yet, yeah, I guess I care a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. At the end of the movie, you in the credits, you mention your parents, Sid and Lorna. Were they funny?
That's a good question. My mother was not intentionally funny almost ever. She made us laugh, but it was almost all unintentional. My father was, he was funny, yeah. He was funny, but also he was a fan of a certain kind of humor, the dry, sarcastic humor that basically, or that I came, you know, basically he taught me what was funny to him, and that's the way I've continued to try to be funny ever since then. As it turned out, a lot of the world doesn't find that funny, but... yeah, he was funny, and both of them, even my mother, even her unintentional humor was very Jewish. You know, she was a martyr. She was, you know, very, that was a Jewish mother martyr. That was a very familiar figure, and yeah, she had the same. I've it's like my father was not trying to be funny when he said this, but, you know, on occasion my mother would ask him, you know, how's the roast this week? I always remember this. Sid, how's the roast this week? And he'd say, I'm eating it, aren't I? that was, I don't think he meant that as a joke.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, very much, very deeply tied into Jewish culture and Jewish humor. He was basically saying, don't ask me to celebrate, you know, and jump up for joy, and, you know, it's like, be happy that I'm eating it.
Yeah.
And don't ask for more than that. So, yeah, I would say I got that from my father.
There were a lot of people that you talked to in this movie, comedians. What was it like with them, interviewing them? I mean, in particular, Bob Einstein, who we all know as Super Dave Osborne, he seems quite caustic. Was that real? Was that part of the shtick, or?
Well, you know, I mean, you're interviewing me. Like, if I started making fun of you, whether you knew that I was doing it for the audience's entertainment or not, I still think you'd probably find it difficult to deal with. So, or maybe I'm wrong about that, but, you know, this is a film where, for the first time ever, rather than interviewing people who had virtually never been interviewed, which is mostly what I've done,
yeah.
I interviewed people that had been interviewed hundreds of times, including, you know, on Johnny Carson and this and that, and it was I can't lie, it was different, and it was a real challenge, and, you know, I might consider myself in terms Toronto to be a funny guy, but these are people that are, you know, funny for a living. They've been exercising that muscle much more than I have. Plus, you know, I'm not there to do stick with them. I'm there to, you know, get something for myself, for my film, and I don't want to... I think that in some cases, if I had engaged in banter with them and given it as much as I took it, they would have been offended and stopped the interview. So, you know, that's what I had to weigh when I was... How much do they want me to hit them back? And how much do they just want to hit me because it's funny, and whether it's real or just for fun, you know, it's irrelevant. I can't think about that. So, you know, I think Bob Einstein was, some of the stuff he said to me was so absurd that it must have been for fun. And some of it was genuine, that he was, yeah, he was taking, he was criticizing me.
Yeah.
And, you know, on my part, I just thought, as long as you're being funny and this will be entertaining for the audience, and as long as you don't criticize me about the things that actually mean something to me, which he, you know, like criticizing me about, you know, having a much younger wife. Well, I mean, I can't argue with that. That's true.
Yeah.
And that she's not Jewish. Yeah. I married a Croatian, and that's why at 60, is 20 years younger than me, and that's why I have a daughter. And you want to make fun of me for that? Go ahead. Like, it's worth it. So, you know, yeah. But in general, every single one of them, Shelley Berman, definitely in a spectacular way, all the ones that shut me down, all the ones that didn't want to talk about what I wanted to talk about, they just, you know, a lot of them basically just want to talk about their showbiz career. If they're in showbiz, that's what they like talking about. Maybe they don't talk about that with their friends, but when the camera's on, that's what they talk about. So that was all a big challenge, and luckily, of course, as you know, you might interview them for an hour and use 3 minutes of it, and that 3 minutes might be just dynamite, so it doesn't really matter what they were doing the other 57 minutes, which in a lot of cases was nothing very helpful to my film.
Now, you don't really, I guess when you make a film, do you have a sort of plan? And I'm wondering in terms of how you work. Do you shoot all the interviews and then put it together?
Yes.
Yeah.
I shoot the interviews until I feel like I have enough. It's almost like I make a meal, and when I'm absolutely full, then I know, okay, I've probably given myself... I'm basically just looking for choices, just looking for if the first thing I lay down is a blue card and the next one has to be a red, I need 10 choices of red in order to make the film the way I like to make it. I don't know if that's a good analogy, but, you know, yes, I know the way I edit. I know the way I construct the story. So I'm looking, but I know that in order to do that effectively, I need to give myself lots of choices within each element. So, yes, we shot, I don't know how many interviews, but basically we shot like 21, 22 days of interviews, which is maybe, you know, maybe two a day, an average. I'm not sure. Yeah, go ahead. And then we cut for a few months.
And then looking back at it, was there anyone you wanted to talk to but didn't?
Well, there were tons. I mean, you know, it's like every famous Jewish comedian that there is was on our list. You know, Seinfeld, Jon Stewart, Woody Allen. Mel Brooks was who I wanted. Sarah Silverman, Richard Lewis, Gary Shandling. I mean, I don't know those, you know. I mean, I didn't really think Seinfeld would do it. Larry David, I thought he might do it. Mel Brooks was the one I wanted because I just simply wanted to meet him, and I thought he was the funniest Jewish person ever, and also his humor and even his age. He, you know, is the 2,000-year-old man is the most perfect manifestation of Jewish humor that I could point to. That character just is thoroughly Jewish humor, and it was a very popular record. You know, that was astonishing to us, and I know that even they thought so. They thought this little character, this little old Jewish man character that we're doing at parties, how could the non-Jews ever want that? But no, you know, the non-Jews liked it, and it was a big hit. So Mel Brooks, he's been a sort of hero of mine, and I really hoped I could get to talk to him. Now, as it turns out, if I had gone to talk to every famous person that I tried to interview, I wouldn't have been able to make the film that I made, and I don't think it would have been as good.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there was Richard, I was scared to interview Richard Lewis, but I wanted to. I mean, some of these people, David Steinberg, David Brenner, whatever, these are people that, you know, I was starstruck, right?
Yeah.
But I couldn't. I was starstruck by Gilbert Gottfried, like, but I, you know, you got to pretend that you're not.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard. But yeah, there. I mean, I was very grateful for the ones I got. It was to get, I don't know, just like to drive out to Palm Springs and have Shecky Green open the door for you when you ring the bell was amazing.
Yeah.
But Woody Allen would have been great. I would have gotten Woody Allen, Mel Brooks, and Sarah Silverman. I would have been happy. But
And you never gave thought to interviewing non-Jews?
No, I didn't. I mean, I didn't because on some level, first of all, I didn't want to make the film about, the Jewish humor is the easiest way to talk about the film, but I don't think to me, the film is about Jewish culture. And so I just really wanted to know from other Jews, sort of like, how's it going with you? Then the other thing was, I knew that if I made a film and 40 people were Jewish and one wasn't, people would be going, hey, I didn't know Chris Rock was Jewish. And it's like, no, he's not. He's the one non-Jew in the film. So I know Jews would do that. If there was one person in the film they thought wasn't Jewish, they'd be like, what?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't think he was Jewish. And no, he's not. He's a token non-Jew.
Yeah.
So I just didn't want to have to explain that. I wanted to be able to say everybody's Jewish.
And in looking back at Jewish humor, essentially Jewish culture, as you have in this movie, do you understand yourself better?
I do, actually. You know what? I mean, there are certain truths about yourself or about the world that you can hear 100 times, and you can study in school, and you could write an essay about it, and still it doesn't quite penetrate your heart, and you don't really know it. And the one that I didn't really get was that complaining was funny.
Yeah.
You know, it seems counterintuitive. And so somebody said to me just something really simple, wasn't even that funny. They said, if you say, I went to the, you know, there's a lot of jokes about people having trouble at the Department of Motor Vehicles or in Canada, whatever we call it, the Ministry of, I can't
remember. Yeah, transportation or something like that.
Transportation,
yeah.
Or something. So if somebody says, I went to the ministry today to renew my license, it was a breeze. I was out of there in 5 minutes. There's no humor there.
Yeah.
If things go, only humor when things go wrong. And that explained a lot to me because on some level what it explained to me was why, number one, why people thought I was negative, which is something that, you know, pertains to the other film you mentioned, My Eye Curmudgeon.
Yeah.
Why did people think I was negative? And why did I persist in being that way? Even though I found out at a certain point that people don't like it that much. And I realize a lot of it just comes so natural to me. Because when I was a kid, that's what was funny. That's what made people laugh, to talk about how things went wrong. And, you know, that's what's also interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing's interesting about things going right. You know, there's no good movie about everything going right.
It'd be a boring movie. Yeah. How are you in terms of watching your movies? Is that something that you enjoy doing?
Not that much.
Yeah.
You know, like, I've seen this, well, I mean, since it's finished, I saw, you know, it's, let's say, played three times at TIFF, so
yeah.
I went to the first one, but I didn't go to the next two. This particular film, compared to others of mine, is somewhat easier to watch with an audience. Because, see, when I watch a film with the audience, I'm watching the audience. I'm not really watching the film, and I'm just hoping that they give me a sense that they like it as much as I want them to like it. So it'll be a couple years before I'll be able to watch the film and just watch the film and not watch the audience. And with this film, you know, I need, even though the whole film is not about laughing, I need them to laugh a certain amount. And if they do, then I feel good, and if they don't, and I feel bad. And knowing that about myself, that's the reason I sort of stay away, because every single person in the audience could think that it's the greatest single greatest film they've ever seen in their life, but I could walk out of there going, oh, they hated it. So on that level, that's why after one or two screenings at the beginning of the run, I stay away. But I will watch it again, you know, in a year or so, more to see whether you know, I think I succeeded as much as I wanted to. You know, the film has done much better than I thought it would, and that's been a real interesting journey for me to try and figure out why people like it more than I thought they would. But I'm starting to figure that out, and so I'll do that. I'll watch it again someday to help me figure that out.
I sat behind you during a screening of I, Curmudgeon in Vancouver, and I was watching you. I mean,
wow.
That's, you know, I mean, and
you're a stalker.
But the funny thing is, I could sense that you were uncomfortable, and that you got up, I don't know, the last quarter of the movie, I guess, and so I just assumed that you were uncomfortable. And then,
the funny thing about I, Curmudgeon, that particular movie, is a very interesting example of the whole thing we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So when that film played its premiere in Toronto at the Boer, I remember this night very distinctly. It played like a full-on comedy, start to finish. People were killing themselves. The people were laughing in so many places that I didn't think they would. Now, I somewhat understand that now, is that it's because everybody in the movie is complaining, and that's funny.
Yeah.
But I didn't intend it to be as funny as they were taking it. So I know that by the time probably I got to Vancouver, you know, it's sort of like people in Toronto laughed, and people in Toronto liked the film. So in Vancouver, if they weren't laughing as much, my interpretation might have been, oh, they're not liking it. Or the other thing is, just like I said, as I said to you, people could be loving it, but it's hard to know that when you're just sitting there trying to gauge an audience, which is really, if there is a science to it, I am not an expert at it. So probably I was sitting there going, you know what? Leave, and then if people tell you they liked it, maybe you'll believe them, because it's better you not be here.
Yeah.
I do remember that screening, though.
And then I saw you afterwards. You were outside of the theater sitting there.
Yeah.
And because
did I look like my best friend had died?
He looked tortured almost. He looked like you were worried.
Well,
about,
you know what?
Yeah.
I mean, this is something nobody ever talks about, or I never hear anybody talk about. But the thing is, you know, we don't make these films to be in the audience when people watch it. And, of course, if we're lucky, the vast majority of times, we won't be in the audience. We make the films in some ways to have this a conversation with an audience much, much, much bigger than any audience we could ever have a personal relationship with. And so, you know, I know that there are some filmmakers for whom this isn't true, and I don't really understand these people and how they can be like that. But for me, putting a film into the world makes me very, very, very fragile and vulnerable. And, you know, I don't know. I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but that's, let's just leave it there.
Yeah.
So it's probably better for me not to be around. You know, you go there kind of hoping that people will essentially carry you out on their shoulders and therefore, you know, defeat your feelings of vulnerability and fragility. Well, vulnerability, I think, is the better word. So, yeah, I mean, I go because I want to, you know, I do want to experience it, but there's another part of me doesn't want to experience it, basically just wants to, you know, here, get an email from somebody who was there. You know, if I get an email from somebody who was there and they tell me they loved it, that's great. If I get five, that's even better. If I get a couple of people stop me in the street and tell me, that's good.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and I extrapolate from that that there must be many more. But if you're there, yeah, you're just nervously watching the audience and wondering if they hate it.
Well, I loved it, and I guess I should have told you that. All I did was sort of nod at you, and you nodded back, and then I went on my way.
Yeah, no, you know, I don't expect everybody to tell me. And, you know, that particular film I'm proud of in retrospect. I feel like, you know, I tried to do something that nobody had ever done, and I came close to succeeding. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe I've come off a little neurotic in this last part of our interview, but I just say that, you know, filmmakers come to festivals and they go to the front and they introduce and they come back for the Q&A and everybody applauds. And one can imagine that they're just like, you know, like a great comedian who's put on a great show and they're just, you know, feeling great about everything. But for me, it's like, no, it's like the weirdest thing there is to present the thing that you've been working on a year to the audience that you made it for and hope that, you know, I hope that nothing short of, that they love it. There's nothing, you know, when people say, oh, I enjoyed that for me, that's like, yeah, not good enough. That's not why I made it. I want, you know, I'm trying to change your life. That's what I want to do.
Well, I think with this movie, when Jews Were Funny, you change the way people look at humor, and they give us a new perspective about it, and then you give us the story of your life, which I think is fascinating. I mean, this is a great movie. Congratulations on it, Alan, and continued good luck with it. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today.
Okay, well, thank you. I enjoyed it myself.
The website for more, whenjewswerefunny.com. It's at the Van City Theater here in Vancouver starting the 20th of December. Visit viff.org for tickets. Alan Zweig joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planto.